Good morning and welcome to Cosmic Influence. My name is Walter Cruttenden and I'm here again with co-host Jeff Pitino.
How are you?
And once again, we're the guys at the Binary Research Institute, and we are looking at this whole idea that ancient civilizations might have known more than they're currently being credited with, and particularly at the idea of a great year, a possible cycle of time that was embraced by so many ancient cultures, over 30 is the latest count, and the idea that they had some knowledge perhaps about methods of agriculture, methods of living, which might be very beneficial to us today. And so in the process of looking at this whole idea of what they knew or didn't know, we've been interviewing all sorts of scientists, independent researchers, authors. And today we have with us a very special individual who's both a scientist, an author, and quite an explorer, adventurer. And his name is Tom Brophy, and Jeff will give a little background on Tom here.
I'd be happy to. Dr. Thomas Brophy teaches integral philosophy, physics, and archaeoastronomy. He has a PhD from the University of Colorado, worked with the NASA and Japan space programs, and was dean of an integrally oriented graduate school. He has authored many scientific articles and two books, and has presented at numerous international conferences on both scientific and integral spirituality topics.
And he had also was a member of the Voyage 2 spacecraft instrument team, and so we'll have to be sure to ask him about that today. Tom, you on the line?
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, thanks for joining us today on the Cosmic Influence.
Nice to be here. Good morning, Walter.
Yeah, you know, obviously I want to talk to you about Nabta Playa, but first I understand you recently got back from a trip to Egypt, which sounded really fun. You guys take a couple of land cruisers?
Yeah, I get these visions of like Indiana Jones like adventure, just like scrawling across the desert.
It was an interesting expedition. In April of this year, we had three Land Rovers, and we went into the far southwestern desert of Egypt. What's called the Gilf-Tabir region and the Gebel Uwainat region, which is actually at the corner of Egypt, Libya, and Sudan.
Mm. It's pretty remote. What's the landscape out there?
Well, it's hyper arid, extremely dry, and very hot. But along the way, you take the You leave the road around Dakhla Oasis or Farafra Oasis, which is just west of the Nile. It's a line of oases there, and that's where you leave the road and you go off in the desert. In the desert, you go through hundreds of kilometers of mostly flat, lots of sand, the Great Sand Sea, they call it. Then you come to the Gilf Kabir, which is Gilf is a word for like a table mesa, a kind of a big mountain out there.
Mm-hmm.
And Jebel is another type of mountain mesa that's Gebel Uwainat. So you get out there and you finally see these beautiful big mountains that we've not known much about until recent decades, actually. And it's kind of surprising that this region is not really fully explored yet, and that so few people have been there. In recent years, apparently, there are more of these tracks that go in jeeps, but there are still regions that are not all that explored. And we were going. Part of our purpose was to revisit for the first time these two sites that had been discovered in November of 2007 by Mahmoud Murai, the guy who was leading our group.
I see. How large was the group, and were there other scientists or authors?
Yeah, so it was Mahmoud Murai, Robert Bouval. So Murai and Bouval kind of got it going to revisit those two sites. And then myself and there were like 8 of us total, and or I guess 9 with 3 drivers.
Okay. And did you go by Nob de Playa also on the way? Is it in that? It's in that.
No, on that trip, it's not really on the way.
Okay.
And after we got back to the Oasis, I split off and went to Nob de Playa with a driver. And permits.
Okay, great. And so, in essence, what did you find?
Well, we had sort of four basic goals, places to visit. First one, which is not all that deep in the desert, is what's called Jedefre's Water Mountain, which is a site with rock art and cartouches and hieroglyphs from known to be from Pharaoh Jedefre's time.
Which is when, roughly?
It was 4th dynasty.
Okay, so pretty early.
The time of building the pyramids. The standardly accepted time of building the pyramid.
Exactly, yeah, right. And so is there anything there other than the rock carvings at that particular place?
Yeah. We found an alignment that we think the site seems to have been used for sort of solar temple tracking the annual motion of the sun, the solstices and the equinoxes. There's a flat-topped mountain due east of the main face with the hieroglyphs and petroglyphs on it that faces due east. And we were camping in front of that mountain, and actually it was Bouval who first noticed, hey, this is due east, and it's facing due east, and he started wondering about the solar alignments of the rising sun. So before dawn, we went up and I took GPS measures on the mountain, and we went back to the site and back to the site of the petroglyphs and measured there and re-looked at them, and after analyzing the data, it appears that there is a nice alignment to the equinoxes of the rising sun as viewed from there and the solstices. So we're starting to call it Jedefre's Sun Temple now, and we wrote a little paper about that.
Oh, interesting. So one of the markers is the hieroglyphs on the lower plane there, and then what are the points of demarcation on the mountain then?
So on this mountain, it's kind of a flat. It is a kind of a flat top mountain that's due east, and there's a notch in the center of it that we noticed as an obvious notch when we went up there to measure it and look around, and that is the notch that is nicely aligned with the equinox's rising sun, but there's no other marks there. It's just the positioning of that mountain and the positioning of the petroglyph and hieroglyph face and other markings on the face itself that suggest this sun temple use.
Got it.
Was this something you guys had expected you might find in planning the trip and going there, or was it
no,
rather unexpected?
No, that find was kind of serendipitous. This so-called Jedefre Water Mountain was only discovered, I think, near 2000 or 2002. I have to look that up by another independent explorer. I think it's Carlo Bergman, who goes around in on a little camel train just himself. He found it recently. So that site has also not been all that heavily studied yet, although there is a German archaeological team that goes there every year. But they seem to have not noticed this sun temple alignments.
Good, and so it's fairly undisturbed too. So that's the first site. That sounds very interesting. And where else did you go then?
Okay, second site is called Bagnold Circle, which is a small stone circle, kind of a little reminiscent of the small circle at Napta Playa. And Bagnold Circle is far out near the Libyan border, and that was the second site we got.
And what are the rough? What's the rough diameter and the size of the average stone?
So I think it's about 8 meter diameter.
Okay.
And the average stones they like come up to your knee.
Okay.
Yeah. Or smaller.
All right, but presumably the surrounding, there's not a lot of these stones just sitting around the surrounding area. It's not just a random.
Right. At Bagnold's Circle, it's on a flat sand area, quite possibly is a playa, like Napta Playa. And the stones are still in place. Most of them are still there, although they're so eroded that some have, the tops have fallen over, and some have fallen over. But there's not a lot. There aren't other standing stones in the area, so it's pretty isolated and very clear circle still there.
Right. I'm curious, what were these circles used for, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's pretty clear the circle at Napta Playa was used for astronomy of various types. And Bagnold Circle is less clearly, less certainly used for astronomy, but we think it probably was also. And when you say used for astronomy, that can mean a lot of things, just a convenient place to look at the sky, as it's moving, or whether it had specific alignments, that's possible too. Anyhow, we found that Bagnold's circle had not been measured. There was a photograph of it from 1930 by Ralph Bagnold, who discovered it. It was he was a British officer and desert explorer. And it had only been visited a few times since then. There was another photo from, I have to look it up, the 80s. But they hadn't even measured, exactly where north and east and west were with respect to the circle. So that's one of the things we did.
Hmm.
And the circle does seem to have very clear east-west aligned set of stones and north-south aligned set of stones. And there are features in the horizon away from the circle that we think might have been used for the astronomy viewing.
Interesting. So, okay, where are you off to after that then?
Okay, then we went to through the Gilf Kebir region and stopped at a well-known rock art site called the Cave of the Swimmers, and that was featured in that movie, The English Patient. So we saw these, and then we went to the newly discovered site, Cave, of cave paintings, found by Mirai last year, in that same region.
Interesting. What are these pictures of? They're in a cave, presumably, but...
So they're... The petroglyphs, the paintings in rock art in this area are of people and animals, a lot of cattle, but interestingly also a lot of giraffes and animals that lived back lived there back when the area was not desert. And
oh, yeah.
Was,
which is probably,
yeah.
I mean, that's quite well, some time ago, isn't
and
it?
And that's a, something yeah. I think a lot of people don't realize is that the whole area of the Sahara for several thousand years ago was not desert at all, and that it was actually very, very livable.
Yeah. But
yeah.
I think the timing is more like, at least Schock had mentioned, it's like 8,000 years ago when it was vegetation.
This area is believed to have become hyper-arid like it is now about 3,600 BC. So that's, almost 6,000 years ago. And it went through a couple of phases before that of hyper-aridity. So, that kind of gives you
a
limit that these paintings tend to be at least 6,000 years old. Some are much older.
Yeah. And is that the best way to date it, or has there been any carbon studies or samples?
I don't think there's been a lot of carbon dating of the rock art.
Yeah, I meant of course. Finding fires or anything nearby or anything like that, evidence of.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's pretty generally accepted that they range from 6,000 years old to back to, like 12,000 years old.
Yeah.
And the different characteristics of them, like the finely engraved engravings rather than, the painted on things, tend to be older, apparently. The engravings tend to be older.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. Even 6,000 to 12,000 years ago, 20 years ago would have been almost blasphemy. But these numbers are being tossed around more often, especially in light of all the amazing finds they've been making in Turkey.
Göbekli Tepe, is that how it's pronounced? This site in Turkey, it does seem to be amazing.
Yeah. I've just been, Jeff and I were talking about that yesterday. The fact that site was buried apparently by the ancients kept it so well preserved is just really amazing.
Yeah, buried on purpose. Was that 8,000 BC? Buried? Sorry.
Well, it dates to 9th to 10th millennia BC.
Yeah.
So, 11, 12,000 years ago. And some of these things are just in perfect shape, which to me gives a little credence to Schock's argument on the Sphinx. The Sphinx was buried for quite a while, at least the base of it in the enclosure, because it just fills up with sand naturally. And that's so tremendously eroded, and here's something else that was buried, and it's not eroded at all. And I realize that there's difference in climate settings, but...
I think one of the more fascinating questions is why was it buried in the first place?
Yeah, that is. Yeah, very interesting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I agree. It's fascinating.
So. But just to finish with your trip, and then there's a final site, a fourth site?
Yeah, the pharaonic cartouche that's out in Gebel Owayna, it's actually in Sudan. It's Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom hieroglyphs, Egyptian hieroglyphs, including a cartouche that was found way out there. That's why it's an important find, because it's the first time such a hieroglyphs were found so far away from the Nile.
Hmm. And is there much to the site?
There's not a lot there. There's this cartouche that Marai and Borda found last November that's on a rock face that's in a kind of open area on the side of a hill. So there's not a lot else besides that there. But in the same region, we also found, we visited some known rock art sites, and there's quite a few of them, and found some new ones, and actually found a probable solstice-aligned engraved arrow on one of these rock art sites.
Okay, well, we want to hear a little bit more about that, as well as Nabta Playa and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. Thomas, right before the break, you were talking about the site that you went to last where you had found, or they had found cartouches that are the farthest away from Egypt. And what's significant about that?
Well, so it shows that the pharaohs sent expeditions out that far, which wasn't generally known before, and in that direction, you know, to the west, not just to the south. And this specific hieroglyph mentions the kingdom of Yam, which is briefly mentioned in some of the Middle Kingdom texts found, you know, along the Nile. And the expeditions to the Kingdom of Yam were known about, but it was assumed that Yam was in Upper Egypt, you know, south along the Nile, whereas this suggests that it may have been far west, and so it sort of expands the range in which the pharaohs were traveling and trading, and it may point to this new understanding of this kingdom of Yam.
Interesting. And you mentioned you found an arrow there too. What form does this arrow take?
Yeah, nearby, several kilometers away, there's lots of these rock art sites, and up on a ledge, an elevated ledge, on the base of that, somebody found several engraved marks, nicely, you know, nicely worked engravings. So I scrambled up there, and there's one, you know, pointing to the northwest, and got out my electronic compass, measured it, and it seems to be a clearly nice arrow pointing to the summer solstice sunset. So there seems to be, you know, a evidence of this solar astronomy going far back in this region.
Very good. Great. So before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you, too, about Nabta Playa. So after this trip, you mentioned you then went by yourself and a driver, presumably, to Nabta Playa.
But before we go there, I think let's talk about how you first got interested in Nabta Playa, and what specifically about the site is.
Oh, good
is
point.
Really,
yeah, when did you
first
visit Nabta Playa, Tom?
I first visited in 2003, but I started studying the data about Nabta. I think it was about 2001. And I got interested in the astronomy there from first checking the astronomy at Giza, you know, about whether the Great Pyramids line up with Orion's Belt and how that matching worked and when. So that's how I first started to look into archaeoastronomy in the region. And there was a reason why, after studying that I started to consider sites further south, and ran across that 1998 article in Nature magazine about the calendar circle at Nabta. So
And what was the reason why that led you to look farther south?
Well, that might take longer than the show to describe, but the suggestions of a certain type of astronomy that I thought might be at Giza would suggest the same type of astronomy being followed further south. So I think that's kind of the quickest way to say it.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that, but we will remind our listeners, whose curiosity you have piqued, that you wrote this book called The Origin Map, and which talks about Nabta Playa, and I'm sure there's more information in there, isn't there, Tom?
Oh, yeah, there's quite a bit.
Okay.
And we'll actually have the origin map in the bookstore at CPAC.
Okay, that's great, as well as Tom's other book, The Mystery and the...
The Mechanism Demands a Mysticism.
Right, exactly.
Okay, good.
What drew you back then?
Let me finish about the calendar circle at Nabta Playa. So in that 1998 article in Nature, they noted the solstice alignment on the calendar circle, but there were obviously another set of six stones in the center of the circle that were unexplained, of unknown meaning. So that's what I first did when studying Nabta, was approached those six stones as a kind of a puzzle. Well, what could those have meant? That was the first thing I started studying.
And the short answer on what those six stones do?
Well, I think those six stones, together with the circle itself and the solstice alignments, might have worked together to make that calendar circle and not sort of a teaching diagram that would tell the users of the circle how the sky moved. That's metaphorically how the sky appears to move. The sun moves on an annual cycle, and the stars move on what you call the great year cycle. And it seemed to me that the circle could have been used that way, as this teaching diagram that tells the users how the sky moves, both on the annual cycle and the long-term precession cycle.
Excellent. And so the stones then in the center had stellar alignments versus equinoctial or solstitial.
Yeah. So the circle has the solstice alignment, the summer solstice sunrise, okay. And that was published in a Nature article. And that tells the user of the diagram when to look, summer solstice, the day of summer solstice. And then there's the north-south gate in the circle that tells them where to look, the north-south or meridian line in the sky. So on the day of summer solstice, just before sunrise, user of the diagram looks in the sky and sees three of the six stars in the center of the circle matched just right with Orion's belt. Mm. And so that tells them which constellation to consider and how to keep using the diagram.
Interesting. So Orion comes up one more time. We're listening, or we're talking with Dr. Thomas Brophy today, the author of The Origin Map, and who will be speaking at CPAC this fall. You're listening to Cosmic Influence. We'll be right back. Tom, I wanted to finish on Nabta Playa and then ask you a few other tangential questions. But at Nabta, are there some things that you noticed then on your last trip that added to your body of knowledge beyond what you had published?
Yeah, a little bit. I went back to look again at some still enigmatic aspects of Nabta. So at Nabta Playa, there's the calendar circle made of small stones. You know, it's about 4 meters across, and the stones come up to about your knee or smaller. And that calendar circle, though, is next to the playa, and in the playa, the ancient dry lake bed,
mm-hmm.
There are large stones, megalithic stones, and they have alignments. And I went back to look again at some of them, but most of Nabta is now gone. The counter circle has been moved away, and some of the megalithic complexes have been removed. I think three of the megaliths have been moved to a museum. But others, like the complex structure A, the central structure, has been excavated, and the sculpture that was found there was moved. So there's not a lot to see now on the ground, unless you know what to look for. And I was looking at some of these megaliths, large stones again.
It seems a tragedy that they they moved it. I know there was some vandalism there, so maybe that was part of the reason, but
well,
what's your input?
Yeah, the talk of vandalism actually came, we didn't know that, and it hadn't been announced that they moved the calendar circle. So when I visited, I did go back to the calendar circle in April, late April, and it was gone. The really nice stones were gone. So I went back to Cairo and told Bouval, and Robert Bouval had been there in November of last year when the circle was still there. So we were wondering what was going on. Excuse me.
Oh, so it was assumed vandalism, and you found out it was
purposeful. Yeah, we started to communicate with the combined prehistoric expedition that has the concession to excavate the site. They go for a few weeks every year. And they said, oh, yeah, we moved them.
Gee. It still seems like you want to keep things in situ as long as possible.
Yeah. It is a problem. You know, all over Egypt there are many important sites, and many of them are very poorly protected. Neftephi is such an important site, though. You would think they could have put a guard there years ago. It's too bad that they didn't.
What's the rough dating on Neftephi?
So, Neftephi, they do have a lot of radiocarbon dates, and they span thousands of years. The big collection of many radiocarbon dates were around 6,000 B.C.
8,000 years ago.
Yeah, and they go back as far as like 8,000 B.C. and then up to the time of onset of hyperaridity, about 3,600 B.C.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, it's just, it's a site I would have liked to have seen one day, but I guess I'm not going to.
They do have enough data, and we're told that they did keep the calendar circle stones and sent them to a museum in Aswan. So, it's possible to reconstruct the site, and hopefully that can be done at some point.
Okay. Well, that's good. And I'm sure your work will play an important role there.
Yeah, it amazes me that vandalism is a problem for some of those sites, especially being as remote as they are. But I guess a lot of careless people just go out and think if they take a small piece, it won't matter much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
Yeah, repeat that too often, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, good. Tom, I know you know you had trained in astronomy and worked there at Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics in Boulder, and I wanted to ask you a little change of subject here about an article I'd read. It's on space.com. I think I first saw it in USA Today about some of the anomalous accelerations of the spacecraft. And, of course, the Pioneer anomaly has been around for a long time, studied by Anderson at JPL. But this year they had this article that says NASA baffled by unexplained force acting on space probe. And I guess they've got four or five others that have experienced this similar acceleration, and nobody really knows why, just that they're not exactly operating as expected. And are you familiar with that article? You follow that sort of thing at all?
Actually, I haven't studied those data, so I can't really say much about that.
Okay. Well, I'll shoot you a link sometime, and maybe I can talk to you, just offline. And
sure,
I'm always curious for an expert opinion on these things.
So, Thomas, your book prior to The Origin Map was a very well done book called The Mechanism Demands of Mysticism.
One of the best books I've ever read, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's. I thought you made some really good points. And for our reader or listeners who aren't familiar with that, I wondered if you might talk a little bit about that book and what inspired you to write it. And
sure. Okay. That book, the central idea, what I tried to do in that book was show how what you might call both an inner aspect of reality and an outer aspect of reality can be seen to coexist within our framework of modern science without a problem. That's sort of the thesis of what I was trying to do in that book. And one of the things I did was bring together what some important founders of modern physics said about that question. You know, is there I use the term now inner and outer, because that's sort of the term used in integral philosophy as mapped out by Ken Wilber, the inner aspect. Some people call it the spirit aspect, and the outer, some people call it the matter aspect.
Okay. Thomas, I hate to do this. I completely lost track of time. We have to take a commercial break.
Okay.
So we'll be right back.
So about your book, you said it's talking about the inner and outer realities. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So using the term inner and outer the way it's used in integral philosophy as mapped out by Ken Wilber, the inner aspect, sort of the mind or non-material aspect of universe, and outer aspect, the measurable external or material aspect of universe. And so the book was attempting to describe how we can have a modern or postmodern reintegration of understanding how these two aspects of universe fit together and coexist without violating or having to propose any new physics, just fitting within our modern understanding of science. So not contained in the physics aspect, but this, you know, physics aspect coexisting with the inner aspect or the spirit aspect of the universe.
Right, and I thought your title was so apropos, the mechanism demands a mysticism. And I think that's what a lot of people feel intuitively. Of course, the scientific approach nowadays is often so, Newtonian, I guess. You know, we want to define the universe like a billiard
that
game.
That title was actually a part of a quote taken from the Nobel Prize winning, one of the sort of the founders of modern quantum physics, Louis de Broglie. And that's one of the things the book looks at, is these founders are, you know, really important founders of modern physics. What they had to say about this question tended to be integral and sort of inclusive, like I'm describing, and not sort of exclusive materialistic, which was interesting.
Well, when you really read the lives of a lot of the great early scientists there, they were all multi-disciplined. And, like Einstein himself said, I have no question there's a God. I just want to know how he did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know Newton sort of took the same approach. Although when we sort of boil down his laws, we kind of throw out the rest of it.
Newton was apparently an interesting character too. You know, he spent more time of his life on theology and metaphysics than he did on physics. But fascinating.
Yeah, and yet those books aren't quite as popular.
I think nobody reads them.
Yeah, he also did a number of kind of odd experiments. He stared at the sun for as long as he could just to see what would happen, and also at one point stuck a sewing needle into his eye socket to see how far it would go. So he made a lot of sacrifices in the name of science.
Yeah, but he wrote a book also on precession. I forget the exact title, but where he's trying to fit history to the precession cycle, the great year. And
Oh, Newton did that?
We have a copy in our office here, and it's a very fascinating look at it. And
well, can I go back to my Mechanisms of Answer Mysticism book?
Oh, please do.
So in the first part of the book, I set up this sort of integrated way of understanding how we can view the both aspects of reality. And then near the end of the book, I have sort of applications of this idea. And one of them I mentioned in that book is where I first started to look at this reintegration, one of those applications, this reintegration of the yuga cycle with the zodiac cycle, and how this newly postmodern understanding of both aspects can reopen questions like, could there be an importance to the yuga cycle, to human culture and the human mind? So that was where I first started to look at that question. And Sri Yukteswar's reintegration of that, as I mentioned in that book, is one of these applications.
Yes, yeah. I remember then you and I, we talked about Sri Yukteswar and how much of his information might be general versus specific. And I still want to sit down and talk with you more about that sometime. But if I think of it, I'll try to box up my copy of Newton's book on his interpretations of the great year and bring that to you.
I'd like to see that, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Good. So, curious what you're working on now. What's the future hold for you? What's your next big project?
Well, I'm working with Robert Bouval and Mahmoud Marai to do a book to sort of follow up on that expedition that we were talking about and contextualize those finds together with this sort of emerging view of prehistoric astronomy. So that's something I'm working on now.
Interesting. You know, I just wonder if these stone circles and similar megalithic or Neolithic sites might have some purpose beyond astronomy. And I'm curious, did you catch the presentation by John Burke last year by any chance? Talked about Avebury. And
I'm not sure. I don't remember specifically.
Yeah, just a real quick scientist, and he found that the 66 remaining stones at Avebury, and Avebury, of course, has pretty good size stones, and it's the largest stone circle left in the world today in diameter. He took a flux magnetometer to him and took over 1,000 readings over a month he spent there, and found out that the natural polarity of the stone, you know, when the stone's formed by the Earth, it's got a side that faces the North Pole and South Pole, that the stones are aligned in such a way that the positive side always faces the next stone in line. And it raises a lot of questions. So maybe when you're out looking at stones in the future, you can carry a flux magnetometer with you also, and besides the alignment readings, look at some of the other ones.
Oh, yeah. I think the ancient stone sites were probably used for many purposes. And, you know, just because I specifically study the astronomy doesn't mean that I think that was all they were used for.
Yeah. But, okay, well, Tom, unfortunately, we're coming near the end of the show. It's been terrific talking with you, and thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you at CPAC this year.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Enjoyed it.
Listen to Cosmic Influence. That was an interesting interview with Dr. Thomas Brophy, and Tom, as stated, will be at CPAC this October 4th and 5th at UCSD. We'll be in the Mandeville Theater. And we invite all of you to attend. For more information,
Visit the conference website at www.cpaconline.com. That's cpaconline.com. We've got a full list of the presenters, what their topics are going to be. Also, if you're interested in seeing what CPAC's like, you can look at the previous years. We have video clips from those as well. So definitely sign up. We'd love to see all of you there.
It's a great chance to meet these guys in person and ask them whatever questions you have.
So until our next episode,
bring on the higher ages.